neither in the Guadarrama, autumn-winter of 1937, nor in the Segre, spring of 1938, nor in the Ebro, summer-autumn of 1938, it ever occurred to me to insult, and even less mistreat, any prisoner of war. Not even the Italians, some of them quite cocky that I had to lead to the Falset football field one day in August of 1938. And in France, in the guerrilla, just as in Spain, my only obsession was always to harmonize the effectiveness of the actions with the safeguarding of my men. The German prisoners that my detachment took, including an SS captain, were handed over to the French military authorities in the same state that we captured them. But disarmed and without papers, yes. In a way, they also benefited from my obsession. And I must say that one of them was the armed lord and master of the eastern part of the Carcassonne region for almost a week, 20-26 August 1944, during which time I dismissed several municipal councils loyal to Marshal Pétain and their respective mayors. In the case of one of them, I could have taken justice into my own hands, as in the case of the mayor of Douzens, a certain Montlaur, who, in the autumn of 1940, had behaved miserably towards a dozen families of Spanish refugees living in his municipality. With a bit of bad luck, after that inhuman behavior, many of them could have ended up in a German extermination camp, as happened in central France, in the Angoulême region. But my detachment did not bother anyone in the least. And of their leader, a servant, those villagers keep, I know, having visited them this past summer, a good memory. There, in 1944, there was no nervousness, no shouting, and even less hysterical gestures on our part. I am not going, with false modesty, to ask for forgiveness for having presented myself as a model. I could have cited dozens of cases, many of them are in my books, but I preferred to talk about the case that was closest to hand and that, in this situation, could best serve, if it serves any purpose, those who would feel some inclination to study my mind, my paranormal resources or other internal or peripheral powers. So, if it is clear that the man and woman of tomorrow are formed in today's child, and that this is formed at home, at school and on the street, it will be no less clear that what we should do is not to stir up the small amounts of bad temper that, apparently, we all store inside us, but to cultivate the good inclinations, generosity and love, or the companionship that one is capable of. And that is the end of the matter. And let's hammer this home, we have come into the world, Antonio Gala tells us with beautiful and, at the same time, painful words, to try to be happy, and we will not be able to be fully happy except to the extent that all those around us are also happy, even if they are thousands of kilometers away from us and their skin is a different color than ours. I could also talk about my experience in a Spanish prison, in the winter of 1945-1946. Particularly with boys of gypsy descent, they worked as caretakers in Girona, apparently, whom I met in my 40s and had as students in the prison school later. I lived with one of them in quarantine for several days. According to society he was a criminal, but I can say that there he gave me proof of an exemplary spirit of solidarity, being a complete stranger to him, and a politician, so as to not miss a detail. But that would be prolonging this chapter too much, but perhaps not unnecessarily. I want to say, however, that from a very young age I heard my father say that man was born good, and that it was society that made him bad. I confess that, at times, I came to doubt it, but at this point I recognize that my father, and all those who thought like him, were right. The sociologist Andrew Yin and the researcher Carl Sagan confirm it for us, scientifically, in these pages. My father also said that it was and is within the reach of each one of us, the possibility of ensuring that society fulfills its corresponding mission, to provide the means for all its members to be good people and happy people. Before finishing, another brief clarification, from my paternal grandfather, Pons Ferrer, a federal republican who already fought with the public forces in Valencia, demonstrating in support of the autonomy demands of the Cubans and the Filipinos, through my father, Bons Sismas, one of the founders of the CNT Woodworkers Union in Barcelona, myself, Bons Prids, and my four children, Pons Santano. In our family we are already in the fourth generation of people totally disconnected and totally unconcerned with everything religious. In other words, we are not, nor have we ever been, immersed in crises of faith. Nor have other people's crises of this type caused us depression or trauma of any kind. Let each one eat his own bread. Consequently, the extraterrestrials, and specifically the crew of the ship Light of the Cosmos, have not appeared to me in the form of virgins or saints, as some people apparently claim to have seen, neither under the guise of demons or genii, as a followers of esoteric traditions seem to see them, nor in the form of mysterious initiates, as scholars or pseudo-scholars of the occult claim to see them. On the other hand, my father also told us that the best preacher is the one who preaches by example and, if possible, makes it clear that he does not obtain any material gain from preaching. Well, in view of the lucrative commercial schemes that this group of mind-altering investigators, of conscience and of the most intimate and dark recesses of the human being have set up, one wonders what these people would have been doing today if UFOs had not fallen from the sky, never so apartment a phrase, on them. What kind of sects or congregations would have been invented to feed their egomania and try to conceal this sum of imbalances from which, in my opinion, most of those who hang out with the extraterrestrial phenomenon suffer, and which range from sexual decrepitude to the most overwhelming cultural poverty. A serious and extremely delicate state of alarming repercussions, knowing, as is well known, that both balances, to fulfill their respective functions to the letter, must complement each other admirably, fantastically and wonderfully. We have thought it appropriate to add some notes, sometimes extensive, at the end of each chapter for several specific reasons. A. They are often the extension of the subject addressed or outlined. B. Sometimes it is a subject that overlaps with the preceding one, although it is also another story. C. On other occasions, as is the case of the physicist and astronomer from Perpignan, François Arago, some characters are briefly mentioned because their activities and personal career are instructive, and D, finally, because they can serve as a clue when the reader needs to obtain more information on a specific subject. Naturally, the treatment of the subject of extraterrestrial spaceships, and above all that of their occupants and the world from which they come, has revealed to us, the layman, the immense seduction that radiates from the stage in which we all move and act, the universe. Hence, in addition to the appendices and notes, which we have tried to summarize as much as possible, we have considered it necessary to highlight at the end of the book, in the works consulted, the works that we recommend to the friendly reader so that he can enter, in an enjoyable and profitable way, into the infinite and marvelous universe. On the other hand, the author remains at the disposal of the reader who wishes more information on any of the subjects mentioned here, sometimes very superficially, and to those who request it in a letter addressed to the editorial Planeta, and in my name, he will send an extensive photocopy of the extracted works or provide all kinds of information on books, magazines and organizations from which documentation on a certain subject can be requested, agriculture, ecology, forests, the sea, the message, and from other worlds, August 31, 1981, WHOER. We are the representatives of an infinite number of planets inhabited by humans and animals of all species, which make up the harmonious universal brotherhood. Our desires, for many centuries, to establish fraternal contact with the inhabitants of planet Earth. Only their warlike nature and destructive actions have made definitive contact impossible. From the most remote times, and by all means at our disposal, we have tried to attest to our existence and our intentions, and we longed for the Earth to focus all its intelligence and efforts on corresponding to our attempts. Instead of that, recently the most civilized powers have tried to keep many of our appearances on Earth secret. Since we are people of peace, we have limited ourselves to periodically visiting the Earth and observing it, always with the hope that one day the longed-for definitive contact would be established. Contact that has not been possible, we repeat, because of your wars, in which, over time, reveal an escalating destructive capability, until reaching the current situation, in which the planet Earth can blow itself up into millions of fragments, at any given day. Our hopes and our fears. When the superpowers of the Earth began to launch spaceships into the cosmos, we harbored the fragile hope that they were messages of peace. But we soon realized that such actions were only new ventures with a view to consolidating the military power of the two superpowers that dominate and enslave the planet Earth. Thus yielding, once again, to the secular temptation of domination, enslavement and extermination of one's neighbor, the fruit of the immeasurable pride and dangerous imbecility of those who hold political, military and spiritual power on Earth. That is why our apparitions, which are now also police operations, have proliferated so much in this last quarter of a century. Today, in 1981, we can assure the inhabitants of Earth that one of these superpowers is planning to set up military bases in space to threaten and blackmail all terrestrial communities in general, and the other superpower in particular. Although we have always been saddened by seeing the inhabitants of Earth destroy each other and use their intelligence to find more horrible means of destruction, we, faithful to our cosmic ethics of not intervening in the development of other lives, and even less of coercing or violating them, have always abstained from acting on Earth. However, today, when one of the two superpowers threatens the harmonious universal order, established in brotherhood for many centuries, with the transport of highly destructive machines in its spaceships, we have decided to send this message, which we hope will not be intercepted or adulterated as has happened on other occasions. Our warning, always with fraternal aims, is, however, very serious and resolute. This superpower, whose identity, for now, we will not reveal, must immediately abandon this mad project, because, otherwise and without warning, in reality this message must be considered as a warning, we will proceed to the indefinite freezing of all life in the area of its national territory and in its bases scattered throughout the planet Earth and in space. We have more than enough means to do so, means that we have been discovering, throughout many centuries, seeking the ferment of life and not the empire of death, unknown on the planets of the harmonious universal brotherhood. And we want to emphasize that this warning also applies to the other superpower and to all those communities on Earth that may give in to the temptation of dominating the universe. A ridiculous claim, when they have not yet been able to know and master the planet on which they are born, live and die. And to all these communities, large and small, powerful and powerless, we say that definitive contact with us can only be established when it is clear that the Earth wishes to live in peace with itself and with others. And that, instead of traversing cosmic space with warlike and destructive intentions, it should dedicate its main efforts and resources to thoroughly understanding the characteristics and marvelous resources of its planet, the only way that it can one day, in turn, defeat death, giving life its only source of subsistence, that of the endless discovery of the immense and infinite wonders of the universe. Given on a mountain range on Earth, in the mind of a terrestrial messenger, on the night of August 31st to September 1st 1981. A postscript to a message: if our daily work does not sparkle with poetic brilliance, it is not life that we will live but, day after day, death will come our way. Henry David Thoreau. Perhaps all civilizations considerably more advanced than ours have achieved effective personal immortality and have lost the motivation to wander through interstellar spaces, which, for all we know, may be a typical need of adolescent civilizations, wrote Carl Sagan. I remember that, in the early 1950s, the so-called UFO phenomenon began to occupy increasingly important spaces in all kinds of media and, very particularly, in magazines with a more or less sensational tone. I was living in the south of France at the time and, as a writer of literary scripts for the cinema, I made frequent trips to Paris. In one of them, in the spring of 1950, I came across a French magazine, Noirek Blanc, in whose pages I saw for the first time some drawings depicting supposed flying saucers, accompanied by a text that was passably fanciful, but which, in my opinion, had its own charm. For me, at least, it did, since on October 31, 1952, I deposited with the Society of Film Authors in Paris a literary script, registered under number 13,829, entitled Adventure on Venus, and later, after a revision, Destination, Venus, inspired a little by the report in Noirek Blanc, but in which I had let my imagination fly, starting from some questions that anyone, in that situation, could ask themselves. Why shouldn't there be other inhabited planets? And if there were, why couldn't their inhabitants be more civilized, happy and perfect than us? And if this is so, why this insistence on relating to us who, every now and then, throughout our history, were more than showing that we were neither civilized, nor intelligent, nor, of course, happy, and that we were increasingly further away from perfection? Now that I am ready to be honest, I will say that another of my sources of inspiration for writing my script, in which the subject was treated by me as a musical comedy, was a film from the 1930s, entitled The Last Man on Earth, starring, if I remember correctly, Conchita Montenegro and Raul Rulin, who were Spanish actors based in Hollywood. I clarify, in both cases they were rather light inspirations, let's say from the start, which one updated and, if possible, anticipated in time and space, since I pointed out realities that have later been confirmed. I must also point out that, from then until now, almost 30 years ago, the subject of UFOs never particularly attracted me. To say that I did not have a single book dedicated to them in my well-stocked library says it all. I read carefully, of course, everything that fell into my hands, magazines, newspapers, as one reads something that is already taken for granted, but which one finds, for the average person, still has a certain mysterious aura and is awakening increasing interest. It was now, after the encounter with the crew of an extraterrestrial spaceship, that, for 4 months, I have immersed myself in specialized books and magazines. More than anything to see what levels the UFO subject was going through at ground level and to what extremes of fantasy, or morbidity, the Earthlings had reached, who, apparently, are so interested and passionate about the subject in question. I must confess that I was greatly disappointed. I will go into details later. Now let us limit ourselves to adding a few notes to the ultimatum message. The famous young researcher Carl Sagan is the author who has impressed me the most. And not only because of his work, which seems to me to be extremely important, but also because of his sincerity. He does not mince his words and, above all, he is capable of asking a series of questions which, according to my own experience, contain the essence, or rather, the essences, of life in other worlds. Sagan points out the possibility of immortality in other civilizations. This is the point that surprised and astonished me the most in the mouths of the extraterrestrials, the statement that for them death did not exist and, consequently, neither did time or space. And when Sagan speaks of perhaps they have lost their motivation to wander through interstellar space, leaving the question hanging in the air, they answer us in the message, when they speak to us of the main incentive of their lives, the endless discovery of the immense and infinite wonders, and resources, of the universe. Discoveries that complete their already deep and extensive knowledge of the cosmos and its latent and changing life. Having made these clarifications, it is possible that reading the communique from other worlds will be more enriching. But there is still more, and it is that at this point no one can doubt that their technological resources, those of the extraterrestrials are inconceivable, at least from our coordinates and through our traditional parameters. On the other hand, because of the way they use these resources appearing and disappearing before us, without harming anything or anyone, like a pure cosmic exhalation one can suspect, and even affirm, that, in effect, they are people of peace. While we, the Earthlings, no one can deny that we are precisely the opposite, people of war. This is what, without a doubt, allowed the German philosopher Kant to coin this statement: the condition of peace among human beings who live beside each other is not a natural situation, status naturalis, for the natural state is rather a condition of war. Thus, as long as the inhabitants of planet Earth are dominated by the destructive and exterminating attitude that we have displayed since our origins, how are we going to pretend to live with other communities whose main reason for being is the cult of life? Moreover, now, when a little less than 100 grams of TNT per head of Earthling would be enough to blow the Earth into millions of pieces, in 1981 we were already dealing with several kilos of the tremendous explosive per capita, and in 1981, not content with having fully assured the destruction of our planet, we are preparing to export this capacity for annihilation to the cosmos. Are there or are there not reasons to despair of Earth civilization? The most suspicious commentators among those who do not believe in the existence of other worlds cannot, however, avoid asking the eternal questions: if extraterrestrials really exist, why don't they make themselves known? And why don't they enter into negotiations with us? Carl Sagan, laconically, gives us a complete answer. Or perhaps there exists in the galaxy a certain ethic of non-interference with backward or emerging civilizations. Perhaps there is a waiting period before we consider it appropriate to make contact, in order to give ourselves a good chance of self-destruction, if that is what we are going to do. Indeed, as Sagan points out, there is an ethic of non-interference. They have repeatedly demonstrated this by their behavior. At least in the matter of not interfering negatively. And this is so much so that, in the course of our long and substantial conversation, they never once allow themselves to take sides, either directly or indirectly, for anything or anyone sharply, that is in relation to Earth affairs. And when we spoke of ordinary things, for example, love, they were very careful not to tell me that love is an immeasurable farce rooted in religion or metaphysics. That is why it gives the loving results generally known to all, but they limited themselves to speaking to me of companionship as the highest feeling of human relations on the planets that are part of the harmonious universal brotherhood. But let us not anticipate. Now they do it, they interfere, through this ultimatum message, because it is we who intend to invade their space, which is also our space, as they stressed to me several times, and interfere in their lives with bellicose ambitions. Therefore, no one should be surprised that, in the last few decades, what was once mere observation of the ideas and comings of the Earthlings, has now been transformed into close surveillance. Certainly, observed from above, our comings and goings must constitute a very depressing spectacle. On the one hand, this suicidal and unprofitable accumulation of destructive means, which has far exceeded the maximum level of our needs. And, on the other, the total lack of originality in the manufacture of these apocalyptic resources, and this despite so many technological advances. The inhabitants of the Earth, even though they have set foot on the Moon, instead of taking off from their secular mediocrity morally speaking, have been entering into a desolate dead end, that of their self-destruction. Because, among other misdeeds of setting, they have committed that of adulterating and discrediting their own language, rendering obsolete the formulas of contact and understanding to which small groups of other Earthlings were breathing, despite everything, some breath of life. And thus all the areas of human coexistence have dangerously cracked. They have decapitated hope and, in the field of creation, they make a total lack of communication and a growing and frightening emptiness reign. The key question of the message remains: what is the superpower that, apparently, already has spaceships ready, prepared to transport all kinds of highly destructive munitions? Beyond more or less reliable press reports, since psychological poisoning remains a very efficient weapon of war, it matters little to know this, because, as we have seen in the arms race, we all know how the spiral of violence develops. Whatever the accused power, everything leads us to fear that the other will not be long in coming, if it has not already done so, in turn having ships capable of endangering the harmonious cosmic order. Which means that the warning contained in the message is valid for the two great terrestrial superpowers, and also for all those who dream of emulating them. Because, the truth is that it is tragicomic that miserable countries, such as India among others, instead of devoting their already scarce resources to alleviate the tremendous misery that their populations suffer, insist on wanting to possess their personal atomic bomb. Caricature of the author, Eduardo Pons Prids, great astronomer of political constellations, his companion in the Milky Way Goni 1965. Why did my good friend add this cosmic dedication to this vision of the Francoist environment? Could Lorenzo Goni be an extraterrestrial before the letter? Eduardo Pons Sistmas, Valencia 1895, Barcelona 1936. He was one of the founders of the Single Union of the Wood Processing Branch, National Confederation of Labor. He was a cabinet maker specialized in artistic or stylistic chairs. Gloria Prids Nuno, Valencia 1896, France 1972. She was the classic companion of the union fighter, acting most of the time in anonymity, but whose presence in the labor struggles was invaluable. She was telephone operator in chief of the Department of Labor of the Generalitat from 1932 to 1939. An unexpected journey. Night of August 31st to September 1st, 1939. 1981. I am convinced that extraterrestrial beings who observe the Earth have visited us for millennia in what are now called flying saucers. These objects are conceived and piloted by intelligent beings of a very high level. Hermann Oberth, father of German space rockets. That day, August 31, 1981, at a little after 8 in the evening, I set out on the road. But, leaving the private road of the hotel, where I had left my companion, I had to turn left and head, after passing through the town of Prats de Molo, towards Perpignan, where I planned to spend the night and leave the next morning for Barcelona. This was due to the enormous eye strain that driving at night causes me. But without knowing why, I turned right. That is, along the road that leads to the border and in the direction of Barcelona, via Camprodon. After about a quarter of an hour, and also without any reason, just before reaching the border I left the national road and went into a forest road, which I drove on for 2 or 3 minutes until the car engine stopped and the headlights went out. I calculated the time and distances to which I refer here 6 days later, when I went to visit the place of the meeting and take some photographs. I immediately attempted to start the car 2 or 3 times without any of the engine parts giving the slightest sign of life. And it is reasonable to think that I pressed the button for the lights in a certain nervousness, since I kept it in my hand. Then I got out of the car and walked 100 steps towards the interior of the forest. Then I returned to the point of departure, without having seen or heard anything, and sat on the front of the car, as if waiting for something or someone. I will say that I suddenly thought of them, of the aliens. But seeing no lights or anything that would give away their presence, I dismissed this idea without really knowing what to think. It didn't take me long to start walking again in the same direction as before, until I reached a bend about 150 meters away. It was still getting light, but I hadn't quite got past the bend when suddenly the right side of the grove, which extended on both sides of the path, lit up, flooded with light, it would be more appropriate to say. It was a veritable sea of light, in which, although white predominated, there were also bands of pink and orange. Although, at times, in the rays of light, a multitude of colors difficult to define were mixed together. It was like a symphony of changing rainbows, quickly and smoothly at the same time. A curious detail, although, as I have already pointed out, I am extremely bothered by the headlights of other cars when I travel by road, I must admit that I did not feel any discomfort at all from that unsurpassed display of luminosity, and the fantastic waterfall of colors not only did not surprise me but acted on me like a delicious sedative. If I had to find an example, I would say that such a state only occurs when I listen to jazz or Brazilian music. From the first moment I had the feeling that all this, so unusual, was something familiar to me. My editor, when I spoke to him about it, spoke of courage, or of recklessness. No, I think that, As far as I am concerned, what is happening is an unusual mixture of curiosity, undoubtedly the result of my early rationalist formation, and a certain burden of unconsciousness, accumulated throughout my eventful and exciting existence. That is surely why I am so worried.